Good morning, everybody. My name's Nora Peel, and I'm the executive director of the Boston Book Festival. This year, the BBF is entering its second decade, and we're doing it in a major way by adding a second day to festival weekend and by cultivating a truly citywide celebration of reading with our festival programs in Roxbury tomorrow and other events like Lit Crawl Boston throughout the year. That kind of growth is exciting, for sure, but it also involves additional investment of staff and financial resources. We're a small, independent nonprofit, which means that we rely on donations from individuals just like you to help support the work that we do and to make sure that everyone has access to amazing conversations like the one you're about to hear today. This year, we're making it super easy, as you saw in the video, to support the work we do. You can text BOOK to 617-300-0877, the number's in your program guide also, and get a link to an incredibly easy mobile donation form, or you can mail us a donation using the envelope in your program guide, or you can visit our main info tent where we have a dip jar that makes it really fun and easy to make a small donation that will help support the work we do, so please come check it out. I'm thrilled to be introducing today's YA keynote, and I'd like to thank Simmons University for being the sponsor of the keynote today. They've been a really consistent supporter of our kids and young adult programming here at the Boston Book Festival for many years. We're thrilled to welcome Marie Lu as this year's YA keynote for the BBF. She's the number one New York Times bestselling author of the Legend series, the Young Elites trilogy, Batman Nightwalkers, and the Warcross series. She graduated from the University of Southern California and jumped into the video game industry where she worked as an artist. Now she's a full-time writer, and she spends her spare hours reading, drawing, playing games, and getting stuck in traffic. She lives in Los Angeles, and we're so pleased to welcome her today. Moderating today's session is Sean Gaetano, the Children's and YA editor of Shelf Awareness, and I'm going to turn things over to her and hand her book back.
Hello, everybody. So to begin, we're going to have Marie read a little bit of her book for us. We want to remind you that immediately following this event, you can purchase the book and you can get it signed in the Gordon Chapel, which is right nearby. So, would you like to read for us, Marie?
Yeah, sure. So, Rebel is a continuation of the Legend series, and I'm going to read a little segment from one of the two major points of view. This is from the point of view of Daniel Alton Wing, formerly known as Day, from the Legend series. Eden's not picking up his phone again. I tap off the virtual ringing icon in my view, swear under my breath, and try calling him one more time. Maybe the connection's bad. I am currently in the pockmarked streets of the Undercity, after all, perched in the shadows on top of a crumbling neon sign overlooking a crowded street. This is the lowest rung of Ross City, the ground floor, where sunlight never reaches and where neon signs advertise the rusty jumble of cheap storefronts lining either side of the road. It's not like this is the best place to make a call to the sky floors. No answer again. I take a deep breath and try not to be annoyed. When we first moved here to Antarctica, I promised myself that I'd never lose my temper with Eden. He survived a gaudy revolution. He lost our parents and nearly his life. He's my little brother, and nothing would ever be worth getting angry with him about, as long as he is alive and healthy. Still, you'd think a kid could get around to calling his brother back now and then. Maybe he's hanging out with his classmates. I don't know much about who he talks to these days. Last time I visited him at school, he seemed friendly with some seniors named Jenna and Emerson, but they're headed into their finals for the year. That means he's going to be out more, doesn't it? The concept of a university, of taking exams without real consequences, is so foreign to me that trying to figure out Eden's life nowadays gets me nowhere. June would probably understand him better. I wonder for a moment if I could use this as an excuse to call her, get her opinion on how Eden might be feeling. My thoughts always wander to June. I fiddle idly with a paperclip ring on my left hand, try to force her out of my head, and call my brother one last time. He doesn't answer. I sigh, give up, and turn on the geolocation tracking on him. That's another feature of Antarctica's level system. You can at least find out where someone is. Any sign of her? A voice comes on in my earpiece. It's from my co-agent, Jessen. I let Eden's geolocator keep searching and instead focus back on my job. My eyes scan the bustling marketplace below me. Not yet, I mutter. Jessen sighs over the line. She's late. Maybe she's not heading out today. Give her a few more minutes, yeah? Fine. Jessen hangs up and I go back to my watch. It's a good thing I'm crouched in the shadows here. People always recognize me for one reason or another. My face is the one they've seen before on the news, on the wanted posters that used to plaster every gaudy jumbotron back in the Republic of America. Now it's the one that appears whenever you've committed a crime against Ross City. It's the one you see right before I arrest you. My name used to be Day, the boy from the streets of the Republic, the fugitive who unwittingly started a revolution. Now, though, I'm Daniel Alton Wing of the Antarctican Intelligence Service. My job is to hunt down the worst criminals in Ross City. Here, apparently, I'm the law. Pretty ironic for me, yeah? And that's it.
Thanks. That was a really fantastic passage to choose. I feel like it really brings people to the story. And it works perfectly well for a whole bunch of questions I have. It's like we planned it or something. So we have Legend was your first book that came out in 2011.
Yeah.
And then Prodigy and Champion both came out in 2013.
Yeah.
And now Rebel is here way out in 2019.
Yeah. I know. It took a while for this one to come out.
Well, and so I was wondering about that. What made you want to come back to this story, and did you always plan to do so?
Yeah, that's a great question. No, I didn't originally plan to come back to this story. I thought that the book or the story was contained in the first trilogy. And at the time when Champion finished, it was, 2013 when it finished. And at the time, I was pretty comfortable with the open ending of Champion. Like, I don't want to give too many spoilers, but vaguely saying it was an open ending for the end of the series. And at the time, I liked that feeling of wondering what happens to the characters after this, and I thought it was a comfortable place to leave them. I have a baby now, but I haven't sent off a kid to college yet, but I imagine that's what it feels like to send a kid off to college, where you're like, I don't know what's going to happen, but, you know, good luck out there, and, like, don't drink too much, and, you know, take care of yourself. So that's kind of how I felt I was leaving my characters. So I let the trilogy finish, and I always knew that there was more story afterwards, but I didn't know if that was something I was ever going to reach. And then over time, I just realized that I just kept thinking about the characters. I was like, what did happen to them? Or, like, what are they doing right now? And I found myself constantly writing these little scenes and snippets and posting them online and releasing little short stories here and there. So I think my readers kind of knew that I wasn't quite letting go yet either. I was just constantly dabbing my foot in, and I was also getting a lot of reader emails as well from people who, this is like my number one most frequently asked question, was like, what happens today in June after the end of Champion? And I was like, I don't know. I think about it too. And then 2016 happened. And I remember at the time feeling very hopeless and helpless about all this political crap that was happening. And I think at some point during that year, I had this feeling where I knew that I wasn't okay anymore with leaving my characters into what if. I felt like, you know, I can vote, I can only do so much in the real world to affect change, but in my world, you know, I am God and I can do anything with my world and my characters. And so I knew I wanted closure for my characters because I wanted to be able to control a world where things could be okay. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of why I went back finally to this world and these characters. I wanted to be able to firmly tell myself that things could be okay for people in this world where they had a war and they had a revolution and young people were kind of fighting and solving things and changing things. So that was ultimately why I went back. And I wanted to give my readers something that was worthy of their time. You know, like, this was like the first series that I had ever written, and you know, those readers who read the first book were, like, they came up with me. Like, I was able to tell them my first story, and so I feel a great deal of, just a great deal of affection for my earliest readers, and I wanted to give them something that was worthy of their support. So hopefully they like the ending of the Legend series.
It's like a gift to your readers.
I hope so.
So that means that, and I was wondering about this, this book as it is coming out in 2019 and the end of this story must be very different than it would have been if you had written it in 2013.
Yes.
Do you think, are there any specific things you can think of that would have changed in that time? Story-wise, specifically.
Story-wise,
obviously, worlds.
It's hard for me to say, just because I didn't write it in 2013, mm-hmm. what it could have been. I think a lot of the politics in the book would have been different. Mm-hmm. I think my brain, along with the brains of many people I know, kind of changed permanently after 2016. And I mean, I've always been interested in politics and history, and that was kind of the reason that I'd gotten into writing Legend in the first place. And you know, that was written during a very different time. But, you know, also a time when you could start seeing the cracks in that. Our system. You know, it was the year 2009. Obama had just been elected, and, you know, there was this air of excitement and hope, and I was excited, but you could also kind of see some problems happening. Like, Gabby Giffords had been shot that year, and, you know, congressional offices were getting, you know, their windows broken, and so I was just like, there's something off about, you know, what's happening in our nation. So I think that was already kind of stirring in my mind, like, those ideas of what happens when you push political systems to the extreme, and what happens when you build a wall between, you know, the two sides of America, and just all these questions were now I'm like, oh God, it's all happening. So yeah, I think it was always kind of there in the series, things that were kind of troubling me, and so I think 2016 just took it to a whole new level, and I think some of the reactions of my characters probably would have been different if it had come out earlier. But ultimately, I hope it still ended on a note of optimism for people, because that was kind of what I wanted to do. I wanted to give an optimistic story out there because I'm just like angry all the time right now. Just like this low undercurrent of anger.
We all are.
Yeah, like we're all just like kind of functioning, but you know, underneath it all, we're just like, ah!
Yeah.
So, I wanted to give something that, you know, could give a little bit of relief to that.
Well, so what I thought was so interesting, and of course, you know, you want to build to a happy ending, but that there has to be conflict first, of course. And so specifically in discussion of contemporary politics and the world you're seeing, you have this quote from someone.
Oh gosh, I hope I didn't
name
the person.
No, I think it's Eden. Uh-huh. But they say, what does it matter anyway if the system's rigged from the start? And you have this system of points, which I find terrifying.
Yeah.
So I would love it if you would tell people a little bit about this point system and then why you decided to go with that for this novel.
Yeah, absolutely. And the most terrifying part of that is it's not even science fiction. This is a real point system, so I'll go into that in a second.
That's but even scarier.
It's very scary, keeping up at night.
Great.
So, yeah, it's totally great. So in this world, there is a futuristic society that now exists in Antarctica. This is about 100 years into the future. The society is one where everything is gamified. What that means is you have an ultimate, like, it's like a credit score, but on steroids that you have that governs everything about your life. So, for example, if you walk down the street and you water a plant, you get a point for yay watering a plant. If you go to school and you do well on a test, you get 5 points for doing well on your test. If you get in a fight at school, you know, you might get minus 50 points from your score. Everything you do adds up in this score. And the government then uses this score to determine where you get to live in the city, whether or not you get to buy first-class tickets on the train, whether you get to buy the good groceries, and so on. Like, it kind of governs everything. It's a technological system built to encourage good behavior and punish bad behavior and therefore build a more moralistic society. So that's the system at work here, and I kind of built it because I was really, I used to work in games, so I'm interested in games and gamifying things and what that means and kind of both the positive and negative implications of that. But the scariest thing is that this almost exact system exists now. It's in China, and they run it as a pilot program right now in several of their big cities, and it's exactly that. It's run on your phones, because in China, for the most part, you use your phone for everything now. Mm-hmm. People don't even carry wallets anymore. Like, you just pay for everything with your phone. You know, do everything through there, so the government tracks everything about you on your phone. Like, they know exactly where you are, what you're doing every day. So everyone has this score now in China. And they're expanding it to the whole country next year in 2020. So it's going to be a system in the most, one of the most populous countries in the world, where you get governed like this. And they do things like, you know, you can't buy first class tickets anymore because you did such and such, or because you lost your job and you haven't been finding a new job, you can't, you know, do this or that. So, it's a real system, and I find that just terrifying that this is a thing that can be used, and the idea that people really believe that a technological system might be more fair, you know, than a democracy, but at the same time, it's made by people, so, you know, it's anything is corruptible if made by people, so, yeah, I don't know. It's troubling.
Well, it's a suggested meritocracy
yes.
that, of course, is built by people with power.
Of course.
And a thing that I thought was so interesting in Rebel was that one of the levels is if you're below a certain level, you're not allowed to get health care
yeah.
because they assume that you're just going to use the drugs for salacious purposes, which yeah. is terrifying.
Yeah, it's not the best system.
It's not the best system, no. But so that's where that came
yeah.
from. And
yeah,
then that's where you... from. Mm-hmm. pulled that whole world building around.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, and also, you know, some of our current healthcare being one of them, like some of our current events kind of went into the thinking of that as well.
So I got very lucky. I went and I saw Marie speak at New York Comic Con. And so I got to hear a bunch of questions that other people asked her. And one of the things was something I had specifically been questioning, which is there's a time jump between Champion, the last book, mm-hmm. and Rebel, this most recent one. It's
yes.
10 years.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the interviewer asked you that, and you said, I didn't even notice that happened.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering what you think made you want to write these older characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the reason why I reacted was like that was that I realized that I had made my readers wait almost as long as they had to wait in the books to be reunited. So I apologize for that in advance. I wanted to revisit these older characters just to see how they had changed and how they were coping. I felt like I hadn't really addressed, you know, I addressed the dystopia. I addressed people kind of defeating a dystopia, but you know, you don't really defeat a dystopia, especially mm-hmm. not after like one war. You're not like, yay, now everything's great. How do you cope after, you know, things settle down? How do you move on from like a traumatic past, and how does that affect you in the future? So I wanted to explore how these two brothers were doing 10 years in the future. You know, Day had been, you know, his childhood was not normal at all. Like, he became this national hero through no choice of his own. Like, he was struggling on the streets and then became suddenly this hero and saw, you know, his family torn apart and all of these traumatic things. And now he's an adult and he's trying to move on. And, you know, he's kind of haunted by his past, but he kind of wants nothing to do with it. He wants to just look forward. He's also very paranoid about his brother, Eden, who's mm-hmm. the other half of the story. Eden was 9 years old at the beginning of the Legends trilogy, so he started the traumatic events of the same war at a much younger age than Day did. You know, he was a child going through it. He doesn't remember a lot of it. He's haunted in a different way. Like, he wants to go back and kind of understand what exactly happened. He thinks about his past all the time, his old home all the time, and he wants to ask his brother, but Day is like, I don't want to talk about it. And so these two brothers are just constantly butting heads now because they are coming at their trauma from very different points of view. And Day, being so paranoid about his brother, wants to follow him everywhere. Like, the entire trilogy was about Day making sure that Eden doesn't die. Like, that was the entire plot of the original trilogy. And so now that, you know, his brother's grown, Day still sees him as this, you know, 10, 12-year-old boy who needs to be followed to the bathroom and to the pool and to the, you know, everywhere to make sure that he's still alive. And Eden's like, dude, I'm like 21. I'm fine. I'm going to be fine. I can go to the bathroom by myself. It's fine. So I wanted to explore that conflict between them and conflict between brothers, conflict of growing up as a boy and learning how to deal with your emotions and asking for help, you know, in a world where it's kind of discouraged to do that.
Yeah.
So all of that kind of went into it.
And so specifically, why did you want to do a sibling relationship as opposed to the relationship you had been doing before, which is more of a romantic relationship?
Right.
Like, what was it that brought you to... I want to show sibling rivalry. Like, what? Do you have a sibling? Are you mad at them?
What's going on? Well, I'm an only child.
Oh, that's
which I think reveals a lot about my stories. So I'm constantly exploring, like, sibling relationships of what if from the point of view of somebody who didn't have siblings. I just find it kind of fascinating to grow up with, you know, somebody your whole life. So, yeah, I think that's probably why I was interested in it. And also because, like, the romantic relationship between Day and June, like, there are definitely some unfinished threads, and that's a huge part of the story. But for the most part, June is kind of stable. Like, she knows who she is. She knows what she wants in life. She's kind of arrived. So there wasn't, like, a ton of conflict on her side to deal with. She's not kind of, like, tortured in the same way as Day and Eden are. So I felt like if I had approached this book from the same romantic point of view as the original trilogy, it would have been half interesting and half very dull. So so I was like, okay, maybe I think like the meat of the conflict here is between these brothers because they clearly have some issues with each other that they need to work out. Eden has a lot of issues and Day has all kinds of issues. So so all of them are just trying to figure each other out, and June is there in a huge capacity, but not as like the central part of the story, just because she's kind of there's not as much conflict happening with her. Mm-hmm.
To spin off briefly, and then we'll come back to this one. You have another book coming up about siblings.
I do.
So it seems like this is a exactly. Was it an only child thing? You were like, okay, now this is what I do. I make siblings.
I make fictional siblings.
What is that? What is that sibling thing coming up?
Yeah. So in March, so March 3rd of 2020, my next book is coming out. It's very different from all of the stuff that I've written before. So I kind of always say that as like a caution, warning, different. It's a standalone. I've never written a standalone before. Well, I guess Batman Nightwalker is kind of a standalone, but it's about Batman, so it's not mine. I don't own Batman. So this one is a standalone. It's a historical fantasy, which I've also never written before, and it's called The Kingdom of Bach. It's about the Mozart siblings. So it's about Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart and Nannerl Mozart, his sister, which very few people know about. Like, I didn't know that he had a sister until I was in my 20s, and but he did, and she was 5 years older than him, and apparently every bit as talented as Wolfgang was at composition, at the piano, and at the violin. But because she was a young woman growing up in 18th century Europe, she was not allowed to become a composer. So when she turned 18, she had to stop and step aside and watch as her brother went on to become Mozart. So I always thought that was really sad, but I found her fascinating. So I read this biography about them, and it turns out they used to tour together through Europe when they were children. They were, I think when they started, Wolfgang was like 5, and Nannerl was maybe 9 or so. And they would play for all the kings and queens of Europe together. And during the carriage rides through Europe, which would take like weeks and weeks and weeks to get somewhere, they toured for like 3 or 4 years at a time. There was nothing to do. They didn't have iPhones, so they were very bored in the carriage. To pass the time, they made up this magical kingdom for themselves that they called the Kingdom of Bach. And they made themselves a king and queen of this land and kind of got really into it, and they had a map made and everything. And I thought that was just fascinating. I was like, oh my God, the Mozart siblings, and they've got this magical kingdom. And I was like, I've got to write a book about this. So that's where the book came from. Mm-hmm. And the book is about Nannerl Mozart growing up with her brother and touring Europe, and at the same time creating this magical kingdom together that begins to seep into their reality. Mm-hmm. And as Nannerl gets older and she starts to become more frustrated with the limitations that are being put on her creativity and her passion, the kingdom becomes darker and more menacing. And it all kind of culminates in a day where she is given a terrible pact from this kingdom that she must choose to take or not take. So that's a little bit about the book. And it's, you know, it's very different from my other stories. There's no explosions in it at all. It's a kind of not even a single
not even
explosion.
One.
No, I think there's a smallpox outbreak. That's it's a kind of a metaphorical explosion of germs. And that's pretty much it. So it's a very different story. It's a little bit quieter than my other books, but hopefully people will like it.
Yeah. Well, but still a really lush world building. Still something where you're really focusing in on building this vibe for your characters. And so that brings us right back into Rebel, because I was thinking about how well you do that with, number one, it's kind of two questions. Mm-hmm. Number one, the snippets of text from government documents.
Yeah.
So there's, at the beginning of different chapters, there are these little pieces of text from, it's the State of the Union from the Nation of Antarctica. What made you want to include these?
Yeah.
How did you write them? And then, do you have like full constitutions from places that don't exist, just like hanging out around your house?
Not hanging out in my house physically.
On your computer?
No, there's definitely like some snippets here and there. Yeah, on my computer, there's definitely folders of like random official documents that I've written. And I've kind of, I like that touch. Like it was something that I started doing in the Young Elite series. I just enjoyed, you know, making up these like fictional books and things in this world to make it just feel more real to me. So I remember watching a few State of the Union addresses and kind of trying to write my own like State of the Union of Antarctica, which is really fun and weird. But that's kind of the beauty of getting to write, you know, science fiction. You just get to be God and create, you know, whatever you want. And that was one of the things I like creating. Yeah,
it does really help create space. It gives you, as a reader, a place in time. It also led to me spending a lot of time, anytime they were in Antarctica, being like, what's outside the dome?
Yeah.
They're in a dome. Show me the outside of the dome.
There's a dead tundra out there.
That's it. That's just all there is.
There's some roads. It's not great. People don't leave the dome very much.
And so within that dome, you have this incredible technologically advanced society. And I was wondering about your process to developing that technology, and then also how you feel about that technology becoming potentially real.
Yeah, I feel very unsettled by it.
Yeah.
So much of it is real. Like, this is the problem with writing science fiction, is that you feel like you're constantly just catching up to what's actually happening in the real world. I remember when I first wrote the ending of Champion, and in Champion, this Antarctica Society is mentioned like in two chapters or so, but it's not very much of it in there. I knew that I wanted to explore more of that, and I was kind of like, oh, I don't get to because the series ended. So then I wrote this entire like other series to explore that idea, which is Warcross. It's my other duology, and that happens in the same timeline as the Legend world. It happens 100 years prior, so it's about like present day.
Warcross has an ancestor in it too,
yes,
right?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. That's I'm so glad you noticed that. Yeah, like the day's ancestors are in the Warcross series. So
Sneaky.
Yeah, sneaky. That was fun to play with. I like Easter eggs. So I wrote this entire series to kind of explore the technological ramifications of, you know, building your entire society off of technology, which is kind of what's happening to us now.
Yeah.
You know, and it moves so quickly that it was very challenging writing a series like Warcross, because it was happening in the now. It's about virtual reality. It's about, you know, augmented reality and anything that, you know, tech can make coming out of, you know, coming out of our tech world, and it's just how quickly it moves, and the fact that we are constantly saying, you know, like, oh, can we do it? Can we do it? It's like this air of optimism, pushing forward technology, but at the same time, you know, then two steps back are us going, should we do it? Should we do it? But wait, and it's always two steps behind, you know, can we do it? So the morality is always kind of chasing technology, and we make things before we really think them through, like the ramifications of creating this technology. And the thing is, like, once you create something, it cannot be unmade. Like, it's out there, Pandora's box is open, mm-hmm. and you can't put it back in, you know? And I think we all saw that, like, again, going back to 2016, which continues to haunt in many ways, the ramifications of technology that we never thought about, you know, happening, and then you see the devastating impact of things like fake news, mm-hmm. and how that can sway an entire world. So it's very unsettling to think about things like that, and unsettling to build these worlds, because I'm always thinking about, like, you know, is this going to be real, and is this going to happen, and what's going to happen if it happens? And it's not even that, you know, I'm predicting it so much as, you know, you kind of just see it in the process of happening as the book is coming out. And speaking of that, like, there's a mind computer interface in Warcross called the Neuralink, which now is in the process of being created by Elon Musk. Like, Elon Musk is creating something called the Neuralink, literally called the Neuralink.
The feed.
The feed. It's coming. The Matrix is coming. And he's like, it's a mind computer interface. It's a chip that you install in your head that logs you onto the internet. And I'm like, why? Why do we need this? And so that's happening. My editor was one who sent that article into me. She's like, just so you know. And I'm like, we need to change our name in the book? Are we going to get sued? It's very unsettling to see science fiction becoming science fact, and technology has given us a lot of great things too, so I don't want to say that it hasn't. It's just, you know, it's some things make the world better, but mostly I think it just makes the world different, you know.
That link in particular is something that, whether fully developed in this novel, mm-hmm. is something that still exists. They have the whole system with the points. Mm-hmm. Everybody's point kind of floats above them.
Yeah, so you can see, like, it hovering over you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so you can see that. And so there's also different advertisements that will show up, but only on your screen.
Right.
Which is what I found particularly terrifying, because how do you feel about the idea of Coke advertising directly on your eyes,
just talking to you, like, just some random Coke, you know, hologram right there saying buy Coke? And, I don't know, it feels both like it would be really, really fun and also really annoying and also kind of terrifying, because now you are, like, seeing things that are not really there. You can kind of do that nowadays, like, they have augmented things out there, you know, it's augmented. But, you know, at some point, will the technology get good enough where you can't tell the difference between what's, you know, actually real and what's not? And do you guys watch Black Mirror? So there's, like, an episode of Black Mirror that talks about this. And, of course, it's a horror episode. And I was like, why?
They're all horror episodes.
They're all horror episodes. Yeah. And, like, I remember the first time I played, like, a VR horror game. It was, like, many years ago, like, right when Oculus was coming out. It was not a good horror game. It was, like, super pixelated in that old, like, Doom sort of way, like, just pixelated brick walls and stuff. But it was so, and it was dark, and there was, like, creepy sounds. But because I was, like, wearing the VR goggles, like, my brain just could not grasp the concept that I wasn't actually in this pixel dungeon. And, like, I could feel my dog, like, pressed against, I was sitting on the couch, clearly, you know, my dog was there, but I was like, oh my god, I'm in this pixel dungeon. I know I'm not actually in this dungeon staring at this monster that's wailing behind me, but you know, I just can't. It's amazing how, like, you can fool a human brain like that. So,
oh, it's so easy.
It's so easy.
I tried a VR thing that meant like you were the top of a tree, and as soon as the tree started moving, I just fell over.
Yeah, you see? Yeah.
That's all. I just like dropped.
Brain's like, this is what happens when a tree falls.
Exactly.
This is how it goes.
We are going to do questions in just a few minutes. Mm-hmm. There is a microphone right in the center. If people would like to start lining up for questions, you are welcome to. We would love to have questions from children and young adults first, and then anything else anyone wants to ask. If you, for some reason, are unable to get up to the microphone, you can raise a hand and we'll come find you. And so while people collect themselves if they're interested, I had a couple more questions.
Yeah.
The first is, you mentioned at Comic-Con that you had written fanfic
yes.
as a child. Would you please tell this kind audience about your fanfic?
Yes. So I wrote my first fanfiction when I was 8 years old. This was my first work of fiction. It was very serious. It was about Sonic the Hedgehog. I was a very big fan. And I wrote a story about how Sonic was running through the woods, and one day this tree falls on him, and he breaks his legs, and he can no longer run. So the whole story was basically about Sonic the Hedgehog recovering from his leg being broken, contemplating his life, and the things that he will do differently now that he is not running. So that was it was a little dark. Yeah.
8 years old.
Yeah, I just, you know.
It's a great way to start writing.
It is a great way to start writing. Just, you know, do terrible things to the characters that you like. I recommend it.
There you go. Kill your darlings, but in exactly. the internet age.
Yes, exactly.
And so, hi. Would you like to tell us your first name and then speak directly into the mic?
My name's Maya.
Hi, Maya.
First, I want to thank you because growing up, I didn't have any Asian authors to look up to. So seeing you succeed is just so inspiring for me.
Thank you. And that means a lot to hear.
Yes. My question is, I'm an aspiring author myself, mm-hmm. and I wanted to know, how do you deal with rejection?
That's a great question, and I love that you're an aspiring author. It's I think that's great. And rejection, it was really hard for me. I won't lie. I first started trying and failing to get published when I was 14. I wrote a really awful novel. Like, nobody wants to read this novel. It's terrible. It was a high fantasy. I sent it out, and I got back 100 rejection letters from every agent that I sent it to. I wrote a second novel. It got me an agent, but he sent it out to, like, every publisher you could think of, and we got back, like, you know, another 100 rejection letters. Then my agent dropped me after I wrote a third book that he didn't like. And then I went back to, you know, I went this like full circle, and now I didn't have an agent, and I was struggling to write another story, and I stopped writing for 2 years because the rejections had just gotten to me that much. And I thought, you know, I can't do this. I'm not creative enough to do this. Maybe this is not in the cards for me, you know. And I had accumulated probably like 300 rejections at that point. And so I stopped for a couple of years, and it took me a while to get my creativity back. But I think that if you are a writer, you just kind of know it in your soul. And if you don't, if you're not writing, you just feel kind of uncomfortable. Like, I can't not write. Like, it's just a part of who I am. And I've heard that from pretty much everybody I know who is an aspiring writer who wants to share their stories. So I think that it gave me some comfort to know that pretty much everyone that I ever talk to gets rejected at some point. The most wildly successful authors that I can think of got rejected. Like, Harry Potter got rejected, like, you know, by everybody, and got accepted by like one publisher. Mm-hmm. So, you know, good for them for like discovering Harry Potter, you know? So you just never know. I finally wrote Legend when I was trying to distract myself from the rejections I was getting from the fourth manuscript that I wrote. At that point, I had accumulated, you know, enough rejections to just have built up a thick skin. And I think that's just what it is. Like, there's really no avoiding rejection. You just kind of get used to it, you know. I really did, honestly, got used to it after a while. Like, at some point, it stops stinging so much when you get so many in your email. So I was just kind of, oh, you know, just another rejection letter. Just add it to the pile. We'll build like a fort later with like rejection letters. And honestly, the best way to cope with it is to keep writing something else. And that was the way that I got around it. You know, after a while, I realized that I just needed to work on something else. I just kept going. And so in that case, you know, the fourth manuscript got rejected by everybody. And then I wrote Legend. And then I wrote Legend and then sent it out, and I got really lucky. And it sold in like 3 days, I think. So it went from like years and years and years of rejection to like getting something accepted in 3 days. So, you know, it was like overnight and 12 years later that it got accepted. So don't worry about it. I know that's easier said than done, but also remember it never really stops. Like rejection, like I still will get, you know, like angry reader emails or people who are disappointed in my books or whatever. And so it's just something that you get used to as a writer. And it's not personal. It's not a rejection of you as a person. It's just a person's opinion. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Hi, what's your
name? Hi, I'm Karina, and I actually finished Rebel a few days ago, and I really, really liked it.
Thank you.
So my question was, what do you miss most about writing through June's point of view, and what did you enjoy most about writing through Eden's?
Oh, that's a great question. I really miss writing June's practical thoughts. Like, June is my girl. She's exactly who I wish I could be more like. You know, she stays calm in moments of panic, and she's always counting things. Like, I did not enjoy writing the counting, by the way. That is not, let's not count that, because, you know, I am not that person. I am not left brain like June is, so it was just like a pain to count her stuff. But I liked writing her moments where she would reason things out and figure things out and use her mind to kind of calm herself, even in like the most desperate situations. So I love that about her. With Eden, I think my favorite part about exploring Eden was exploring how he's kind of like the softer, gentler version of Day. He is a little bit unsure of himself. He is quieter. He likes kind of the softer things. His hobby is, you know, to collect flowers and to press them in books, and he's kind of trying to find his place in the world as a boy who's like that. So I really enjoyed exploring that aspect of him and pairing that against like Day's kind of more bombastic personality. Yeah. So that was probably my favorite part of writing Eden.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello. My name is Brielle.
Hi.
And what inspired you to write The Young Elite, since your other two books are kind of like in the future and mm-hmm. The Young Elites is medieval?
Yeah, for sure. The Young Elites, I wanted to write a story about a girl who becomes a supervillain. And it took me a while to get to that point, but that was essentially what I wanted to write. I wanted to write about what happens when things suck for you and people turn their backs on you, and what happens if you just like, if you just turn your back, you know, on everything, what's it like to write from the point of view of somebody who becomes a villain? And I kind of thought about like what kind of era I would want to set that story in. At first, I thought it would be like in a 1920s kind of era, but that didn't quite work out. I was looking for like a period of time where there was like a giant epidemic. So I was thinking about the Black Death that swept through Europe, you know, in the 1350s, And I thought about, you know, what would happen to somebody if you survive this epidemic, you come out of with some kind of unusual power and you're marked physically on your body with it, and people would hate you for it. It's essentially, you know, X-Men in the Renaissance. So if the X-Men exist in the Renaissance, which I guess they would have, people were scared of everything back then. So, you know, if you were a little bit different, they'd burn you at the stake because they didn't understand what you were. And I feel like that's the kind of era that would cause a girl to become a supervillain. So I think eventually I got to that stage where the concept of my character and the world that I wanted to build kind of came together, and I thought that would be a good pairing for this story.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Hello.
Hi, my name is Alex.
Hi, Alex.
So what advice would you give to people who want to write dystopian stories?
What advice would I give to people who want to write dystopian stories? That's a great question. Specifically for dystopian stories, I would say read a lot. Read a lot of news. Read a lot of history. I think that it's impossible to write dystopian without knowing the dystopias that exist in the real world, that still exist and have existed in the past, for you to create one that might exist in the future. So I would highly recommend doing that. I think that chances are that if you're asking this question, you're already kind of interested in these things, so I think that's great. I think that writing dystopia is a way of understanding the world around us, so the more that you know about what's happening in the real world, the better a dystopia you can write. And in general, as an aspiring writer, I would say don't be afraid to write something that's bad. My first drafts are always bad. They're still bad. Like, I'm writing a bad one right now. And pretty much everyone I know does this. So this is just part of the process. And in the beginning, just remember quantity over quality. Like, you just want to get the word count down. And it's okay if it's bad. You can always go back and fix it. But you can't fix something that doesn't exist. So just remember, the book happens in revisions. Yeah, so keep going with it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Oh, my God. Okay.
You're good. You
my
got
name
it.
Is Jenna. I'm a big fan. I own all of your books.
Oh, thank you.
My question is, who were some of your biggest influences growing up and even now?
Yeah, for writing?
Yeah, for writing.
For writing. I would say my biggest influence book-wise was Brian Jakes, because his Redwall series was the first fantasy series that I ever read. And, like, I remember the day that I checked out Matameo from the library and how that just changed my entire way of reading. And, you know, before that, I hadn't really understood that there was a category called science fiction and fantasy. And then in middle school, I discovered it because of Brian Jakes, and I never went back. So I think I am writing science fiction and fantasy because of Brian Jakes. And J.K. Rowling kind of changed everything for me, too. You know, I was lucky enough to be part of the generation that grew up as the Harry Potter books were coming out. And they were just such magic to me at the time, you know? I still think they're magical. So it kind of changed. It changed my entire generation, I think, into book lovers, and you know, I find that so inspiring. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. I'm looking
thank
forward
you.
To your books becoming movies.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi, my name is Sarah.
Hi.
So I noticed that the cover design of Rebel is slightly different than the previous three books in the series, mm-hmm. and I was wondering, like, how it inspired the plot and how it, like, relates back to the book.
Yeah, so that is a great question, and the cover is all the work of my brilliant publisher, Macmillan, and they came up with this beautiful metallic butterfly, kind of to symbolize Eden's journey in this book, because the book is really Eden's story. Like, he is the one who has the real character arc in this book, and it's to symbolize, you know, butterfly being that he is kind of the softer, gentler character, but that's not a weakness. You know, it's not a weakness to be kind. It's not a weakness to be gentle. And so they put it in this chrome metallic steel, and I just thought that was so gorgeous. It's, you know, it's beautiful, but it's powerful. And there's, like, exploding dust, you know, that's colorful, which I'm really into. So it was all thanks to my publisher. Yeah.
Thank you. It's a very beautiful book.
Thank you.
And it matches, too.
And it matches.
You do.
Yeah.
That with the text.
Yeah, the text is purple.
Magic colors.
Yeah. Magic.
Hi, I'm Carly.
Hi.
So when you write a book, you must make a lot of, like, changes to it. What's the biggest change that you've made in a story?
Oh, wow. what is the biggest change? There are a lot of big changes. I'm trying to think of the biggest one. Well, I'm currently in revision. A first pass revision on my next series coming out next fall called Skyhunter. And the biggest change that I've made for that book is changing the main character from a male to a female. Mm-hmm. That is a huge change. So that is what I am currently doing. And it's kind of changing the structure of the entire story. So I am rewriting a lot of this book, which hopefully will still come out next fall.
Cool. Thank you. I loved Warcross, by the way.
Thank you. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Rifki.
Hi.
I read Legend, the whole trilogy, when I was, like, 14. And after I finished Champion, I sat on my floor and cried for, like, 3 hours.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It was really good.
Thank you.
Thank you for making me cry over it. But how is it for you to write those really emotionally raw scenes or those really action-packed scenes, the scenes that can be really hard for you to put yourself in the character, in the shoes of your characters?
Yeah, I kind of like it. I mean, I will get emotional sometimes when I'm writing the emotional scenes, and I feel like if I don't get a little bit emotional, then I'm not doing the scene correctly. So they definitely do get to me, but I do always enjoy myself when I'm writing it, where I'm just like, oh, this is going to be so sad. It's going to be great.
Can't wait to make a 14-year-old girl cry.
It's going to make a 14-year-old girl cry. Yes.
Thank you.
No, I'm just kidding. I mean, I don't want you to cry, but I do kind of want you.
Thank you.
Here, thank you.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Lucy. When you write, Lucy, do you start from plot or with characters?
That's a great question. When I start writing, do I start with plot or with characters? And it kind of varies for every writer that I know. For me, I tend to start with a character and build from there. For example, with the Legends trilogy, the first inkling of an idea I had for it was I was watching the old movie version of Les Miserables on TV, the one with Liam Neeson, and I just thought it would be really fun to write a teen version of a teen detective versus a teen criminal. Like, that was the original idea. So the two characters came into being first. I had no idea what kind of world they would be set in or what kind of plot they would be. I just knew that these were the two people I was going to be writing about. With the Young Elites, it was kind of the same. I wanted to create a girl who was a supervillain. So she, Adelina, kind of came into being before I really understood what kind of world she was going to be in, before I understood what she was going to do. Warcross was the same. So I think all of my stories are like that. Everything kind of grows out of what I end up discovering about this character. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Jennifer, and if you have one, what was your favorite novel that you wrote?
So. My favorite novel, my favorite child. My favorite child is... Warcross was the most fun to write, I have to say, so I might go with that just because I worked in games. It was such a colorful book to write. I just really, really enjoyed myself writing that first draft, and I never enjoy first drafts. That was the only one that I really kind of enjoyed writing. I would say that Rebel was very deeply satisfying for me to write just because it rounded out the story that I had begun so long ago. Yeah. And can we do one last question since...
We have one more person.
We have one last person. Yeah. Thank you so much for your question.
Hi, my name is Petra. I really appreciate everything that you've written.
Thank
my 12-year-old son, we listen to audiobooks. We buy all the books. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
I love your representation of all the cultures. So my question is kind of twofold. My little one has read Warcross and decided that he wants to write, and he loves video games. And he loves to read. So my question was more like, you did a lot of different jobs in your life before writing. How have those influenced how you world build, and how have you drawn from all of your places to be where you are right now? I want to be able to write one day, and I'm just listening
to
you, super inspired, and just want to hear that question, and I'll sit down.
Of course. No, thank you so much. That's so great. And I love that you read with your son. That's so wonderful. I would say my jobs influenced me enormously for my books. I think everything in life kind of influences what you write, and it's kind of out of your control. Like, it's just, you write what you know, right? So I think that I became interested in politics and history because I majored in political science. And at the time, I thought I was going to be a lawyer. For the good of the world that I didn't become a lawyer. I would be a terrible lawyer. I'm very, like, non-confrontational, which is, like, the job of a lawyer. But because of those classes that I took, I was very interested in it. I took biology in school because I thought I was going to be a doctor. Also for the good of people that I'm not a doctor. I'm going to be that doctor who accidentally leaves a pair of scissors in somebody's stomach. I thought it was really interesting. So those two things show up constantly in my books. And I don't think they would if I hadn't taken those courses in college. I kind of fell accidentally into working in video games, and I absolutely loved it. And that, of course, informed my writing hugely, not just for books that are about gaming, but by the way that I think about worlds. You know, when I visualize my worlds, I kind of see them as like 3D maps, and I think about, you know, plots almost as if they were games, because gaming is, video games are a story as well. You know, they're all kind of media about story. And in games, you are trying to lead your player from one part of the game to the next part of the game. So it is storytelling in a very different way. And I think that by working in that industry, it definitely influenced the way that I structure my stories as well. So all of it kind of goes in. Yeah, thank you so much for your question.
Thank you, everybody, for questions and for coming here. We are selling books in the Gordon Chapel. Yep, in the Gordon Chapel. So if you're interested in buying a book and getting it signed, we're going to be doing that immediately after this event. Okay?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.